one of them might do something that could provoke that kind of escalation. But the real problem is unintended consequences of actions that are out of control. Whatever Israel or Hezbollah or Iran and the United States may want, there may be actions that will precipitate a rapid escalation. And that would really, I mean, the situation is appalling as it is. It really would be infinitely worse. The devastation of Lebanon that would follow, the involvement of northern communities in northern Israel would be devastated as well. But the possibility of that growing even wider is to me terrifying.
Talk about who Biden hears. I mean, on the one hand, you have Jordan canceling the summit. He was going to meet with the king, with the Egyptian president Sisi, and with Mahmoud Abbas, head of the Palestinian Authority, who turned around as soon as the bombing happened and said he wouldn't participate. Then Jordan canceled. Now the U.S. is saying they canceled it mutually. But what exactly this means? So the only image is President Biden hugging Israeli President Herzog and the Prime Minister Netanyahu at the airport when he arrived. But even at home, State Department officials afraid to raise the issue of Palestinian deaths. HuffPo had a very interesting piece on thin ice. Some Biden administration staffers feel stifled discussing the horrors in Gaza. And they talk about a call made by the head. Let me see if I can find this. A call with Muslim staffers where they were told to talk about their concerns. And they talked about being afraid of being fired, of being blacklisted, if they dared raise the actual concern they have about what's happening and what the death toll could be and the position that President Biden is taking right now.
We're moving into a McCarthyite era where expression of sympathy for Palestinians is equated with terrorism and maybe met with police state tactics. Students are being visited by the FBI. I'm not in the least surprised that a government is sending the FBI to talk to student activists, is clamping down on its own employees who dare to express humanitarian sentiments. You are required now to utter a mantra in which you exclusively talk about Israeli suffering. And if you do not do that, you are branded and doxxed and so on and so forth. That's happening in the academic, in academia, in universities. It's happening in companies. And it's, I am sure, happening within the federal government. I have no information about that. But that is in line with the administration's position, which is that this is a one-sided affair in which on the one side is absolute evil, something which, according to administration spokesman, is worse than ISIS, Daesh. And with that kind of Manichaean point of view, clearly anyone who expresses any dissent, you know, you are supporting absolute evil if you talk about anything but the unlimited suffering of Israelis. Now, the suffering of Israelis is unquestionable, but that should be the only obsession of the president and his men and women. Puts the United States in a position where maybe in a sound bubble of the United States, the so-called Western world, it's comfortable. But with the rest of the world, that will not wash, including countries that are not particularly supportive of Palestine, countries like India, China, and so forth. Those are countries that, and other parts of the world, I think, see things the very, very same way. So I don't know that these people understand the degree to which they're harming this country. By this kind of blind, one-sided Israel-first approach.
Let me ask you, Rashid Khalidi, if you were president, if you were President Biden, what would you do right now?
What would I do right now? I would immediately call for a ceasefire. I would make sure that the hostages were released immediately. It is unconscionable that they be held. That would require a negotiation between Israel and Hamas about what the terms for that release would be. I would insist on that. It is absolutely urgent those people be gotten out. Most of those are innocent civilians, certainly the civilians amongst them, or many of them are innocent civilians. The second thing I would do would be to say to Israel, look, there is this Palestine question. It's been the problem for 75 years. If you don't address it, the United States will not be willing to offer unlimited support. And addressing it means talking about Palestinian self-determination, talking about ending the occupation, talking about rolling back settlements, not limiting the unlimited expansion of settlements. I mean, there's a whole set of things which, without which, you will never have a resolution of this. And so I would work towards a lasting resolution of a struggle that's been going on, as I say in the book, for more than 100 years, instead of yet another Band-Aid, yet another attempt to stabilize a status quo, which is massively unfavorable to the Palestinians, and which will only lead to more suffering for everybody concerned. That is an idealistic position, perhaps. But I don't think that anybody who has any sense of how this is likely to develop would say anything different, frankly.
Roisin Khalidi, I want to thank you for being with us. Edward Said, professor of modern Arab studies at Columbia University, author of a number of books, including The 100 Years War on Palestine. We'll link to your New York Times op-ed, The U.S. Should Think Twice About Israel's Plans for Gaza. Coming up, we speak with the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territories. Back in 30 seconds. This is To Mother You by Sinead O'Connor. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. He spoke earlier today.
Immediately before departing for Beijing, I made two urgent humanitarian appeals. To Hamas, for the immediate and unconditional release of the hostages. To Israel, to immediately allow unrestricted access of humanitarian aid to respond to the most basic needs of the people of Gaza, the overwhelming majority of whom are women and children. They cannot justify the acts of terror against civilians committed by Hamas on October 7 that I immediately condemned. But those attacks cannot justify the collective punishment of the Palestinian people. Each of my two humanitarian appeals have a value in themselves. They are not bargaining chips. They are simply the right things to do. And I am horrified by the hundreds of people killed at Al-Ahli Hospital this same day in Gaza by a strike that I strongly condemned earlier today. I call for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire to provide sufficient time and space to help realize my two appeals and to ease the epic human suffering we are witnessing. Too many lives and the fate of the entire region hang on the balance.
We're joined right now by Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territories, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for being with us. Can you respond to what's unfolding right now and to the UN's call for a humanitarian ceasefire at this point? After the deaths of some more than 1,300 Israelis and over 3,300 Palestinians.
Good morning, Hemi, and thank you for having me. What we are watching is a catastrophe of Olympian proportions. It's a humanitarian and political catastrophe. Since the very early hours of this new tragedy unfolding in the occupied Palestinian territory and Israel, I've unequivocally condemned what Hamas has done, its targeting of innocent civilians, its taking hostages, and at the same time, in the same breath, I have condemned the response that has been given by Israel under the pretense of under the pretext of self-defense, and brutal even unprecedented attacks in terms of intensity against a population which has suffered in the Gaza Strip alone five major wars over less than 15 years. So I've said, how the killing of 3,000 civilians, the bombing of hospitals, schools, crowded markets, the leveling of houses, how can it ever be justified as self-defense? And amidst all this, I've said the only reasonable and necessary thing to ask for is an immediate and unconditional ceasefire, which of course must be also accompanied by the release of the civilian hostages that Hamas has taken. There is no way out without a peaceful solution, and it's important, it's imperative for the international community and the U.S. first and foremost to take this opportunity to act even-handedly and with wisdom before we spiral further into abyss, because this is what's going to happen if the situation does not de-escalate.
Spiraling into an abyss. Francesca Albanese, if you could respond first to what happened on October 7th, the surprise Hamas attack that ultimately killed more than 1,300 Israelis. Now, we believe roughly 200 to 250, according to them, are additional people are being held hostage in Gaza. And then if you can respond to the plans of Israel, repeatedly what is said is they want to de-Hamasify Gaza and what that means.
What has happened since the 7th of October is, as I said, unconscionable, has taken everyone, even longtime observers of the situation in Israel-occupied Palestinian territory, by surprise. There is no way that what Hamas has done cannot be condemned as war crimes and possible crimes against humanity, with no prejudice to an investigation that needs to be conducted. And there is already an investigation ongoing by the Commission of Inquiry on the occupied Palestinian territory and Israel. As I said, killing civilians and taking civilian hostages cannot be ever justified. Civilian life must be preserved at all times under all circumstances. And, you know, if we put this in context from a Palestinian perspective, the Palestinians have been under an oppressive regime, a settler colonial regime in the occupied Palestinian territory, which is apartheid by default for decades now. But so while resisting the occupation, resisting this oppression is a legitimate goal under international law, it doesn't give blanket license to kill or to target civilians. So resistance has rules as much as like the conduct of the occupied power, I mean Israel, has rules. And I cannot think of one rule of international humanitarian law that has not been violated. So this is clear. Now, going to Israel's response. Well, there is the opaqueness of declaring, wanting Israel wants to uproot, eradicate Hamas from the Gaza Strip. We have to remember that the Gaza Strip has been under an unlawful blockade for 16 years, and it was already on the brink of humanitarian collapse, according to many sources, primarily the United Nations, other international organizations, even before the 7th of October. And what has happened is an intensification of this unlawfulness, because the blockade has been further tightened by declaring, by cutting off the Gaza Strip from receiving water, electricity, food, essential medicines, while it was also being bombed. I cannot imagine how this can on earth be considered proportional. And again, all this violence, all this brutality unleashed against 2.2 million people, half of whom are children. How can it lead, on the one hand, to the eradication of Hamas, or to the, let's say, the de-escalation of the tension among the Palestinian people in Gaza? And there is another element here, which you rightly pointed to, which is the intent to to move out, I mean, to eradicate Hamas, but also to move out Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. As I myself denounced, there is a risk of ethnic cleansing here, and it wouldn't be the first time. And there is both a declared intent, because there have been countless statements by Israeli leaders wanting to push the people of Gaza out into the Sinai. And there is also the practice, under the fog of war, mass displacement of Palestinians has occurred. In 1947-49, when 750,000 Palestinians were displaced, made refugees and never allowed to return. In 1967, when 350,000 Palestinians were displaced, made refugees, many of them anew for the second time, and never allowed to return. So what is happening now, it's targeting millions of Palestinians. So it would be the largest instance of ethnic cleansing in the history of this tormented land. And it's not possible that it happens under the watch of the international community.
So if you can talk about the rejection of the UN Security Council draft resolution calling for a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. The resolution was introduced Monday. It was introduced by Russia, won the support of Gabon, Mozambique, the United Arab Emirates, and China. Six countries abstained. France, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States voted against the ceasefire resolution.
Amy, it's not a coincidence that I started this interview by saying this is a catastrophe of humanitarian and political Olympian proportion. We can see the failure of the United Nations system to ensure peace and security now, because the fact that the UN Security Council has so far been unable to issue a strong condemnation of what's happening, of what has been committed by Hamas and what is being committed by Israel. This is, again, symptomatic of a decade-long political failure to resolve a situation that has been transformed into a humanitarian emergency, a humanitarian catastrophe, but it remains a political situation that needs to be resolved in line with international law. And it's upon the United Nations Security Council to do so. As I said, this is a critical time to show compassion and to show solidarity with both the Israelis and the Palestinians and act even-handedly. Mm.
I wanted to ask you about the news that Israel is set to ban Al Jazeera from reporting in the occupied territories after the attorney general approved the move. According to the Israeli media, the attorney general, Gali Baharav Meara, and communications minister Shlomo Karchi reached an agreement Tuesday on the wording of emergency regulations to stop Al Jazeera from operating. Francesca Albanese, what does this mean? I mean, here in the United States, and you're not always here, to say the least, but in this country, the news we are getting from the corporate media when it comes to the broadcast and cable networks, there is almost no one reporting regularly from inside Gaza. Al Jazeera does report on the ground in Gaza. The significance of this.
I have to say, I learned this now. I hadn't heard of it yet. It's extremely worrisome because, again, we need information. We need information so that, I mean, everyone, the public opinion and all the more political leaders, there have been very few independent voices reporting from Gaza, let alone after the 7th of October. But Al Jazeera has been an incredible source of information. So it's incredible that this is happening. At the same time, what I want to point to is that both Palestinian and Israeli human rights organizations have done an incredible job over the years, and including these days, in these tragic hours, for both to report and also put in context what's happening. So I do hope that the decision to expel Al Jazeera will be repealed, And this
well, it hasn't happened yet, but they're on the verge, it sounds like.
It shouldn't happen. It shouldn't happen. And this is all the more, it makes all the more necessary for the international community, individual member states, to prevent this from happening.
Well, Francesca Albanese, we want to thank you so much for being with us, United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We end today's show in Israel, where we're joined by Maoz Inon, who lost both his parents, Bilha and Yaakovi Inon, in the surprise attack by Hamas October 7th that killed over 1,300 people in Israel. Maoz is an Israeli peace activist with the movement Standing Together, who's calling for the war to end. His parents lived in a kibbutz, a farming collective just north of the Gaza border. They were 78 and 76 years old. Maoz, our deepest condolences on the loss of your parents.
Thank you, Amy.
Can you talk about your parents and what you are calling for now? Because so often we're hearing the Israeli government use the killing, this mass killing of Israelis, over 1,300 killed, and it's not clear, but between 200 and 250 now held hostage in Gaza, as the rationale for a ground invasion and the bombing now of Gaza.
I'm overwhelmed with what happened to me and to my family and to my community and classmates, friends in our community, Israeli communities around Gaza. Nothing prepared me for this moment that I will be here speaking with you about my tragedy. I wished I was speaking with you about the initiatives the peace and the shared society initiatives I've been taking part in the last 20 years. And I honestly, I'm overwhelmed with everything that's going on. My parents were loving people, an amazing couple, really adored and admired by their colleagues, their friends, their community, and of course by us, my five brothers and sisters, and their 11 grandchildren. They didn't want to harm anyone. They didn't want to fight with anyone. We have close and very tight relationship. We call it even a family relationship with the Bedouin in the Negev. I have many friends, colleagues, partner in Palestine, in Jordan, in Egypt. And what's happening now is just devastating. It's just devastating. And listening to you and your guest, I was crying again. I was crying again because of the term everyone are using. It's the other side team. It's kind of a blame game. Who started it? Who shoot the missile? How many victims there is from each side? And it's just, it's shocking. And we keep using everyone, including you and your guests, the same terms we are using for the last century, the century of this cycle of blood between Israelis and Palestinians. And my cry is to stop the cycle, to stop the cycle of blood, to stop the cycle of war. And I'm crying. I was interviewed a few days ago to the BBC, and I say there that I'm crying not for my parents, I'm crying for those who are going to lose their life in this war. And then my cries didn't help for too many people, hundreds of people. And I'm crying now again with you, and I'm crying to everyone that's watching and listening. We need you to cry with us. Don't blame anyone. Me and my family, we seek no revenge. And we seek no revenge. We just seek peace. We seek for hope. You change the terminology we are using to positive terminology for reconciliation, for recognition, for partnership, and for peace. I'm crying, and I'm begging you. just where the awareness, not to blame anyone, just to stop the war and to build a different future, to break this cycle of blood, to break this game of blood, and to build a new future with hope. And hope, I'm not a scholar, I'm not a spokesman, I'm not a politician, I'm a normal people. I'm working very hard for my living. I'm raising my three beautiful children. I'm married to a beautiful, beautiful and amazing woman. And I never thought something like this might happen to someone like me. You hear it maybe in Ukraine, you hear it in Africa, you hear it in else, like faraway places, and this catastrophe reached me.
Maos,
and it just, yeah.
There is a mass.
I'm very, very emotional. Sorry.
And again, my condolences to you, to your family. Today, there's a mass protest plan for Washington, D.C., led by groups like Jewish Voice for Peace. 24 rabbis will be part of a civil disobedience, apparently. They are calling for an end to the occupation. Do you feel the same way?
I think occupation, of course, but we are in such a risk. And I think now calling for to do these things or the other, we are going back to the terminology. We are using the same terminology that had brought us to this situation. Let's call for peace. Let's call for hope. Let's call for a complete ceasefire. Let's call for building bridges. Of course, I'm against occupation. But it's irrelevant at the moment. There might, or I'm afraid, there will be many, many more victims. And what we all should be focusing now is to stop the war. Very simple message. And we must cry it. We must cry our message to everyone that has a heart that can listen.
Let me ask you, Maoz, there are people, Israeli families in front of the Israeli military headquarters in Tel Aviv, whose families have been taken hostage, either mother, father, daughter, son. And they are there saying the same thing. We often see them in the media describing the horror of what happened to their loved ones. But then the media doesn't go on to say what they're calling for. What do you demand right now of Prime Minister Netanyahu when you talk about ending the war?
Again, I'm calling and I'm crying, not to Benjamin Netanyahu, not to the leader of the Hamas, not to President Biden. I'm crying for humanity, for the entire humanity, for the entire mankind. I'm crying to stop the war. I'm crying for immediate ceasefire, and I'm crying for hope. Hope that will take us from this cycle of blood to a new and bright future. We must build hope. We must build a future, and this future must be based on equality, on partnership, on peace. And this is what I'm crying for. And it's not to blame this or the other, this person or the other. They are irrelevant anymore. We must build a new system.
We want to thank you, Maoz, so much as the show ends. And our condolences again, Israeli peace activists speaking to us from Binyamina, Israel. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you for joining us.
A Renaissance Coffee is open at SFU. Prime Minister and his team have been serving the SFU community with great coffee for more than 20 years. If you're looking for a wholesome meal, delectable desserts, or something to warm yourself and lift your spirits, Renaissance Cafe is the place to be. Featuring fair trade espresso beverages and brewed coffee, Renaissance Coffee is open Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Well, how do you get up and go?
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.